Welcome to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting. It's 3:06 on Friday, September the 16th. I'm Adam Ragusea, filling in for GPB's Bill Nigut. If you're wondering who this guy is, I teach journalism at Mercer University in Macon, and joining me here in GPB's Macon studio is Charles Richardson, opinion editor for the Telegraph newspaper here in Macon. Hello, Charles.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Also with us in Macon is Mercer political science professor Lori Johnson. Hello, Lori.
Hi, Adam.
I'm so glad that we have taken over. Macon has taken over the airwaves today. But up there all by himself in Atlanta is Atlanta Journal-Constitution political reporter Greg Bluestein. Hi, Greg. We're waving.
Hey guys, and I'm sitting in Bill Nigut's seat, so I feel really
you are.
Lonely.
Big chair.
Yeah.
Big chair, baby.
Big chair.
You
to
got
fill.
It. All right, let's go ahead and get started. We're going to talk about a lot of political news, federal news, state news, fun things on the docket for today. Though the first one is just a topic that annoys me, but we'll try to find some wisdom or some legitimate information in it somehow. After Hillary Clinton was caught on camera nearly collapsing last weekend, this has been the week in which we have interrogated the physical health of our major party presidential nominees. Both Clinton and Trump have released medical records, and I'm putting air quotes around records. Some of them were really just kind of doctor's notes. Donald Trump appeared this week on the Dr. Oz show, because that's where you do serious things, to have a review of recent medical exams. Dr. Oz just kind of read through some of these doctor's notes, and here is the Oz himself looking through those papers from Trump's physician. Let's listen.
We're 6'3", 236 pounds. Cholesterol is 169. Blood pressure is 116 over 70. Blood sugar, 99.
That's good, 116 over 70.
Yeah, I mean.
I've always been lucky with blood pressure. I've always had very good blood pressure.
Your liver function, your thyroid function is all normal. You had a colonoscopy performed July 10, 2013, which is normal with no polyps. My goodness, his EKG chest x-ray on April 14th was normal. Your testosterone is 441, which is actually good.
Now, so the question, guys, is from this exercise, did we actually learn anything of value, Lori?
No. I mean, I actually think the line of privacy really should be drawn at your personal medical history. I was grateful we didn't hear anything more personally upsetting in this disclosure, but I mean, certainly the health of the president in terms of successors and that kind of thing matters, but this felt to me just like a story the media needed to fill the time this week.
Is that what we're doing right now?
Maybe.
Maybe. Charles, is there any? I mean, look, it matters whether or not the president is going to drop dead, right?
Well, you know, it does matter. But I sort of disabused myself of all concern over health matters back when Jimmy Carter was president. Hmm. And this, if you have children close by, close your ears. But they reported on poor Jimmy's hemorrhoids.
Mm.
You know, is that important that the president has piles? No. But they reported on it. You know, if you go back in history, we've had many presidents that had serious health issues from way back when that weren't reported on, and the reporters knew about it. FDR had serious health issues, but he wasn't even photographed from certain angles because they did not want to invade his privacy, particularly when you're guiding the country through a Great Depression and a little thing called a world war.
Greg Bluestein up in Atlanta, what about the revelations about Clinton's health this week? The fact that she has walking pneumonia, at least according to her doctor, that is significant, right? That's important to know.
It is important to know, especially after all the rumors and really fed by right-wing media. But there was a lot of feedback and talk from voters that they're worried about Hillary Clinton's health. They're worried about stunt doubles. There's all these conspiracy theories. So it certainly didn't help whatsoever that there was actually something, you know, realistically happening where she seemed to collapse or at least get lightheaded at that 9/11 ceremony and had to be ushered out and then didn't tell the media that was traveling with her for more than 90 minutes, which also didn't help her case, and didn't tell some of her own staff members that she had been diagnosed with pneumonia a few days earlier.
But do you think the people that believe those conspiracy theories are reassured at all by these medical records? I don't think so.
Oh, they're not going to be reassured.
I mean, the ones that think, she has Parkinson's, you know, how do you combat that factually when people are convinced that she's got Parkinson's and Bill Clinton's really just trying to run for a third term.
The secret conspiracy theories. But there is the argument, I don't need to know Donald Trump's sperm count. I don't need to know his testosterone level. But I do need to know, I think voters do need to know the basic elements. You know, do you have cancerous polyps on your colon? And those kinds of things. Because as you guys have mentioned, there have been case after case in our own history with Wilson, FDR, Kennedy, Reagan, mm-hmm. of you know, real significant health hurdles that were kept undisclosed to the public that transformed history.
Well, we'll get back to FDR and sort of substantive health problems, life-threatening health problems in a minute. But before we leave the silly stuff, here's Donald Trump on the trail in Ohio when he was questioned about Hillary Clinton's stamina. Let's listen.
I don't know, folks. You think Hillary would be able to stand up here for an hour and do this? I don't think so.
So it's really kind of getting to who would win in a fight, Trump or Clinton.
Well, I'm not
is
sure.
This hopelessly gendered? Can we even talk about this without being at least implicitly sexist in some ways?
Well, I think no, you can't talk about it without being implicitly sexist. But walking pneumonia doesn't have any gender bias.
No.
You either get it and you stumble or you fall over. I had it 18 months ago. I thought I could power through it, too. And I'm a pretty powerful guy.
You are.
And if it hadn't been for somebody at the office that said, sit down, we're calling 911, I would have gotten into my vehicle and tried to come back over here to work. I was nuts. And I had been to the doctor that Monday, and I was in the hospital on Wednesday. But you male, female, whatever, mm-hmm. it knocks you down.
Mm-hmm. But Lori, there are tropes of female frailty at work
absolutely.
Here, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think you can talk about it apart from gender when Donald Trump is saying it, when his masculinity and his virility is so much a part of his identity and how he attacks opponents all the time, then, you know, it's going to be gendered. I mean, I think that how they don't get sicker than they do is
yeah.
what I wonder when they're yeah. shaking hands with people and taking selfies and on airplanes and
working
maintaining
crazy
these crazy
hours.
20-hour,
yeah,
18-hour schedules. And guys, yeah. this is also the run-up to – this is why this the first debate next Monday is going to be so interesting because mm-hmm. – you know, these same themes, the you know, the high energy Donald Trump, masculine man going up against Hillary Clinton on the same stage together will be in the spotlight. And we'll be talking about it for the next 2 weeks out until the next debate.
Maybe she should come out in a tracksuit.
You know, that's virile.
I mean, he used the same tactics against Jeb Bush and Ben Carson.
Kind of
low
worked,
energy,
isn't it?
Not manly enough.
Right. Yeah. We are speaking about the week's political news here on Political Rewind on GPB. We've got Charles Richardson from The Telegraph in Macon on the mic. Also, Lori Johnson, political scientist at Mercer University. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Greg Bluestein. I'm Adam Ragusea. And let's talk about something a little bit more substantive on the topic of candidate health. Earlier in this week, I had a chance to interview historian Joseph Leleveld on GPB's On Second Thought. He's written a book about FDR's last days down in Warm Springs. Remember, Roosevelt died in office mm-hmm. while the U.S. was fighting World War II. Let's listen to Leleveld put all of this stuff into perspective.
You mentioned Mrs. Clinton's problem this morning. She took sick yesterday. And we knew it within minutes, and it's all over the papers today. There was never a moment like that when the papers were full of details of Franklin Roosevelt's decline. On the other hand, remember, Roosevelt was a cripple, in much worse shape physically in terms of his ability to get around than the American people understood. He couldn't take a step on his own. He couldn't get dressed by himself. There were many things he couldn't do without assistance.
All right. So that's a lot more serious than, you know, just mm-hmm. almost taking a tumble when you're really, really sick, and understandably so. That said, FDR died. He apparently had not kept Truman read in on the war, the treaty negotiations, any of that.
The A-bomb.
The A-bomb, exactly.
They hardly talked.
They hardly talked. And yet Truman wins the war, right?
Mm-hmm.
Marshall Plan happens, and the New World Order is ushered into existence nonetheless. So here's the kind of the provocative argument I want to throw out to you guys, which is, does it really matter that much if a president gets seriously ill or even if a president dies? we have other people to do these jobs. Is this all just celebrity obsession, cult of personality stuff? Is there a substantive risk when a president dies? Lori?
I mean, I think the concerns about transparency are real, but no, the president is not a one-person government. There are plenty of other people who are informed and know what's going on. And I think, yes, our fixation and obsession with both the presidency and the campaign for the presidency is really misleading given how government actually works.
I would agree to you until now.
Okay.
I think during FDR's time, you look at the people in Congress, you look at the senators, you looked at Truman himself. They were of a different metal than they are now.
Yeah, they were professionals.
They were professionals. Right. They actually tried to get things done.
Right.
For the last 8 years, maybe longer than that, we have not been trying to get things done. Nobody is stepping up to the plate and saying and putting what's good for the country above petty partisanship, and that probably hasn't happened for the last 20 years. FDR came along at a time where presidential travel was very difficult, even if you weren't a cripple. You were getting on trains. Mm-hmm. You were getting on boats. You weren't, you know, getting on an interstate. There was no interstate highway system. So here he was. Our American spirit was tougher then, and he was able to have somebody at the ready, even when you didn't think he was ready. But today, we've got a whole different group.
It's also the case that Donald Trump is this sui generis person, right? And I think if he were to die in office or get mm-hmm. seriously sick in office, a Mike Pence presidency would be a really different thing, right, Greg?
Drastically different. And I was going to add this, too. I mean, most of the people going to the polls over the next few months, early voting, and, of course, November 8th, they're not going to elect Tim Kaine or Mike Pence. They're going for their candidate or to oppose the other candidate. And that's why government just, you know, moving along would be even a Tim Kaine presidency would be drastically different than a Hillary Clinton, even though those two are mostly on the same page. I'd also add, too, that the media was complicit in hiding FDR's problems, of course, because the reporters who covered the White House knew very well, but there was sort of an unspoken bond that they wouldn't report the true nature of his disease. And I think the American people, you know, who knows, it was a long time ago, but the American people should deserve to know how sick he was.
Right. And, you know, we would probably have the good sense, even if they had known, that they would have elected him anyway.
Yeah, probably.
Three times.
Well, speaking of which, Sam Burnham, a listener on Twitter, tells us that both major party candidates, and he's putting major in quote marks there, both major party candidates, there's plenty to disqualify them without ever even mentioning them health, run on issues, Sam says. And we'll talk a little bit more about issues after a break. We're also going to talk a little bit more about the major party candidates versus the minor party candidates. Is voting for a third party candidate a hopeless exercise or even a self-defeating exercise in our system? As our resident political scientist, Lori, will be going to you for that.
Thanks.
Lori Johnson with Mercer University.
Wish I had better news.
She's in the studio with us. She's a political science professor at Mercer. We've also got Charles Richardson, who's the opinion page editor for The Telegraph in Macon with us, and Greg Bluestein, who's a crack political reporter for the AJC up in Atlanta. I'm Adam Ragusea. What time is it? It is 3:19 on September the 16th. This is Political Rewind, and we'll be right back after a break.
You only have a little time left to enter our drawing to win a beach getaway for two and give GPB's fall membership campaign a strong start. Go to gpb.org right now to make your contribution, and you'll automatically enter our drawing to win a St. Simons Island vacation at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. It includes a three-night oceanfront stay, a round of golf, and scrumptious meals. Please do your part now at gpb.org. Thank you for listening, and thanks for your support.
You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB, an 18-station radio network of Georgia Public Broadcasting. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching.
It's Political Rewind from GPB. I'm Adam Ragusea in today for Bill Nigut. I almost did Beniget, which would be a pretty efficient way of referring to him, and I think I'm going to do that from now on. Anywho, happy Friday to you guys. I'm a little bit slap happy, as far as you can tell. We've got Charles Richardson from The Telegraph in Macon here on the program. Laurie Johnson, political scientist at Mercer University. And Greg Bluestein from the AJC is up in Atlanta. Curious story out of Henry County this week. A Republican candidate running for district attorney dropped out of the race and said, in effect, that liberal billionaire George Soros made him do it. Greg, you reported on this. Can you fill us in on this one?
Yeah, a PAC funded by George Soros, who's spent millions of dollars trying to elect liberal or left-leaning candidates all over the nation, spent about $91,000 on the Democratic candidate, who's actually a DeKalb assistant DA for the Henry County DA's job. Of course, the Democrat then there was always favored for that election. Because of name rec and because of the way that county's leaning. But the Republican always sort of had an uphill battle, but then abruptly resigned suspended his campaign, I should say, right. after the news that George Soros was funding his opponent's candidacy emerged. There's all sorts of rumors there that other things are going on, but his stated reason for doing that was, I can't compete with George Soros.
And it is, in fact, the case, as Politico reported, I think, earlier this week, that Soros's organization has been directing a lot of donations toward candidates, people of color candidates running for district attorney posts in localities around the country who are running on a platform of criminal justice reform.
Absolutely.
And I suppose the question is that kind of intervention in the democratic process by a very wealthy individual legitimate? Laurie.
I mean, I would actually take the question a different direction and say, if you're concerned about criminal justice reform, it makes perfect sense to target district attorney races. That's where the decisions are made. It's, I think, a great example of where there are a lot of positions that we aren't paying any attention to because we're so focused on the presidency that actually have the potential to make much larger difference in our community. And so whether you do or don't like George Soros, I think strategically it makes a lot of sense. If this is your issue, if criminal justice is your issue, district attorneys are where the power is.
But liberals love to complain about those Koch brothers pouring money into local races to affect issues that the Koch brothers care very deeply about. Conservatives love to do the same thing about George Soros. Are these really either of these figures the puppet masters that we make them out to be, Charles?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
yes, they are. I mean, money talks in politics. And if you don't have the money, you don't have the funds to fight the battle, it makes it much more difficult. It is a way to get your ideas across, whether those are left-wing ideas or right-wing ideas or whatever you want to call the ideas, and you have certain people that are willing to fund those ideas. The Koch brothers are one, and George Soros is another. And you have those people who have those resources on both sides that are funding their ideas.
And those guys
now, do
know.
Do you like it?
Go ahead, Greg.
No, I said those guys know that in these local races, $100,000 in a presidential contest
makes a huge difference.
Will buy
yeah.
you one TV ad if you're lucky. But $100,000 in a DA's race could swing the entire election. And so they're trying to appeal from the ground up. And it's, you know, in Henry County, it's already working.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, although I will say most of the research shows money certainly matters in elections, but it doesn't overcome a lot of other deficits that you might have. Mm-hmm. Self-funded candidates actually don't traditionally do very well because they don't have the electoral support that comes with raising money.
Yeah. And the networking. It takes a lot of networking to raise money. And you also have to have the qualifications.
Right.
I don't care how much money you put behind me to run for DA. I don't know anything about the law.
Oh, but you're a big man in this town, Charles. You could totally.
You've got name rec.
It doesn't matter. I've got name rec, but you know, I can't lie to you like that. I just can't.
And in Georgia, we're seeing very different. Like we saw David Perdue, obviously, who pumped millions into his own campaign in 2014. But he already had his cousin Sonny and his cousin's entire political establishment network behind him. And then you're seeing Jim Barksdale, who's waging a very uphill battle, and he's already pumped $3 million into his campaign this year. So you're going to kind of see the two opposite sides of what it means to pump money into your own campaign here in Georgia.
Yeah, for a job that pays less than 200 G's.
Exactly.
It's Political Rewind on GPB. Let's move on to another story here. Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed is at the White House today helping President Obama to push Congress on passing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, something that both major party presidential nominees say they oppose. But Kasim Reed and President Obama still very, very bullish, very much in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and they're working on it today. I'm going to attempt a 30-second explanation of the TPP. Everybody ready?
And China is not part of it.
No, China is not part of it. Thank you. Here we go. Countries like to tax imports to make them more expensive. That way people will be more likely to buy domestically produced goods. Everybody got that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on. Those taxes are called tariffs. TPP is a treaty by which the United States and a bunch of Pacific Rim countries, not including China, would agree to drop their tariffs and other trade barriers, or at least some of them, on each other, the same way that the U.S. and Mexico and Canada did with each other in the 90s with NAFTA. Everybody clear on that?
Got it.
Okay. Republicans used to love free trade. They loved free trade because big business loves trade. They make money with trade and with trade barriers being dropped. Democrats used to hate trade because unions hate trade. Working class people hate trade. It's been terrible for a lot of working class jobs, especially in towns like Macon and all kinds of other places around Georgia and the South. Now you've got this Democratic urban mayor, Kasim Reed, and his fellow big city Democratic mayor is pushing for trade with President Obama while the Republican nominee is out there promising to institute massive tariffs to basically kill global trade. What happened here, Lori?
I wish I had an explanation. I mean, I think part of it is the unwillingness to recognize the downside of trade. There's certainly a positive side of it. It grows the economy. It's essential. On the other hand, it does often cost jobs and have consequences for a middle class, working class people. There are ways to address those concerns and still have trade. So the whole way that we're framing it in terms of it's either trade or jobs is really a false dichotomy.
For Kasim Reed, I mean, it's a no-brainer. If he looks out of his office and he looks at all the big corporations in the city of Atlanta, what else is he to do?
It's also he's living in a global logistics hub that makes money by importing goods and people from other countries and moving them around.
That's right. He's got the largest airport in the nation, the busiest airport in the nation, and it's a no-brainer.
Biggest
airline. He wants that market.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, and the fact that China's not the part of it is actually hugely significant because this is an effort to try to combat the influence of China, to join together with Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, and combat the global influence economically of China.
But Greg, let's dig into the politics of trade a little bit more. There would seem superficially to be a bit of a partisanship flip on trade. Now we've got Republicans campaigning against it, some Democrats campaigning for it, though it should be said that Hillary Clinton's official position is against TPP right now
as
well. I think probably just because she knows which way the wind is blowing on that one, at least in terms of public opinion. But I wonder if we're thinking about this wrong by thinking about this as a liberal versus conservative issue. Could it be the case that it's more that the extremes of both liberal and conservative are opposed to trade?
That's actually what I was about to say. It's the sort of the populist.
Forgive me for running over your
point.
No,
it's great. No, it's sort of the populist versus almost establishment. You're seeing a populist takeover of both parties on this issue. Hillary Clinton, as you just mentioned, was pretty much forced to be very unenthusiastic. At first, she was a supporter, if not an aggressive supporter, but a supporter of the deal. And then Bernie Sanders kind of forced her to the left on the issue, and then she had to come out and be much, much more skeptical of the deal. And Donald Trump was skeptical of the deal from the get-go. And both of them are alienating many people in the party. Of course, Hillary Clinton is alienating the people like Kasim Reed, who are supportive of it, and other big city Democrats. And then we already mentioned David Perdue. David Perdue is one of many Republicans that are open to TPP. And his reasoning is that we need to be in the room because one way or another this deal will be struck and we want to be the one striking and not China. But either way, you're seeing pro-trade, big business Republicans really squeamish over Donald Trump's stance because the populist view has taken over both parties on trade.
We've got a tweet here from Raw Dog Buffalo saying that we didn't mention that TPP was negotiated without workers at the table and only corporations. Is it we the people or is it we the corporations? I'm not totally sure how totally accurate that is. But the question, I think, remains is, are we ceasing to have a country that is left versus right? Or is there a new spectrum taking over? Is it insiders versus outsiders? Is that a better way of thinking about the body politic, Lori?
I'm also trying to think of the last time workers were at the table.
I suppose that's
right.
Point.
Good point.
No, I mean, there's certainly a backlash against those insiders. It's hard for me to understand, except for the fact that one of my mentors used to always say, you're always down on what you aren't up on. I mean, people don't seem to understand these issues, and they don't understand the value of expertise and experience and why people in the establishment are actually what keeps it going. And so it's a really easy target.
You know, you have, I can't think of a trade agreement or any global agreement of this size with 12 nations where the workers were at the table. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen.
In token ways, often.
In token ways. Yeah. And there are token things in this particular agreement as far as worker conditions, as far as how much they have to get paid and all that kind of stuff that are in this agreement that, you, if you look at it on the surface, if they can be enforced, sort of says, okay, we're giving a leg up to workers in these countries so that they have to be in environmentally safe places to work.
Greg, last thought on this topic and go to you.
Yeah, and if we're looking at it through an insider versus outsider lens, at what point do the outsiders become insiders too? That's always vexed me as a question.
Right.
Yeah. How long can you be an outsider in government and then still claim you're an outsider? And people are doing that, but it doesn't really jive with me.
You're listening to Political Rewind from GPB. I'm Adam Ragusea. With me in GPB's Macon studio is The Telegraph's opinion page editor, Charles Richardson. Also with us is political science professor at Mercer University, Lori Johnson. Up in GPB's Atlanta studios, all by himself, is Greg Bluestein, a political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You can tweet us at... oh, what is it? Politics GPB. That's right. At Politics GPB. Sorry, this is the third radio show I've hosted today. It's all starting to blend in a little bit. Okay, one more topic before we go to break. The Clinton campaign started a big push this week to discourage people from voting for third-party candidates like Green Party candidate Jill Stein or Libertarian Gary Johnson. Democrats in the Clinton campaign making an argument that voting third party in our system is not just wasteful, it can in fact actually be self-defeating. Al Gore came out of the dustbin of history this week to remind Democrats that if some of them had not voted for the Green Party in 2000, he might have been president instead of Bush. Lori Johnson, political scientist, we're going to ask you for an empirical answer to this question. Is third-party voting a futile exercise or even self-defeating in the American presidential electoral system?
I would answer that yes, if you're hoping that your third party vote is actually going to result in someone winning, or that you're hoping that that third party vote will change the system. And this is a discussion I got in with my students about it. It's like, I believe in policy voting. You should vote for someone who has the policy positions that you agree with. And so if that's libertarian or that's green, that's fine. But don't expect that that's going to bring a systemic change in our electoral processes without actually having a change in our electoral processes. And our processes are designed to reinforce this two-party duopoly. They set the rules, they make those rules to advantage themselves, and until you change those rules, you're not going to have successful, at least electorally, third parties. On the other hand, in our system, third parties have had historically quite an influence in shaping the agenda and the policy positions. So when Ross Perot ran for president, the deficit was on the agenda. He put it on there. He forced the other two candidates to talk about it. That's how third parties really influence in our system with its rules.
But from a partisan political standpoint, Charles, play a Democrat for us. What's the best plan to make in the playbook if you're looking at third-party candidates?
Well, you know, quite frankly, Hillary Clinton has a lot of experience about having a third party in there. Because you remember, Bill didn't get 50% of the vote.
Nope.
You know, so she understands what that could mean. But I think she also has to look at the landscape and say, who's going to run to whom? And who has the best chance of siphoning votes, and where would those votes go? So I think she's kind of, she wants to shore up her fortress, but she's not, I don't think, totally unhappy with the third party influence, because I think she believes that some of those votes, or at least the majority of those votes, may be coming from the other side, giving them a refuge.
And it is interesting, though, with Johnson and Weld polling as well as they are, both the Republican candidates. Governors, they actually seem to be drawing more votes from Hillary than from Trump.
It seems that way at this point.
Exactly.
Very strange.
And that's why Hillary Clinton's campaign is actually targeting libertarian voters this week because of that very reason. And you know, the AJC did a poll a few weeks ago that showed nearly a quarter of voters under 34 were voting for third-party candidates, which was an astounding figure to us.
Millennials.
Yeah, and who are voting for third party. And remember, Jill Stein's not on the ballot. She didn't make the ballot in Georgia. So we expect to see Gary Johnson's numbers. And in our poll, it was something like 11 or 12%. We expect them to swell a little bit because of Jill Stein, but maybe not to that level.
Greg, what is the partisan calculus for Trump and his supporters? What do third party candidates do for them?
Well, I mean, every vote for even though a fraction of the Gary Johnson supporters would maybe otherwise be Clinton supporters, they certainly don't want any attention on Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. And then a spot of breaking news, both Gary Johnson and Jill Stein failed to make the cut for the first presidential debate next Monday.
Ah, yes, just Politico is reporting that right now.
Yeah, just announced. So that is good. I'm really, for both main party candidates, that's great news because with the race so close, they don't want any attention on any of the other candidates. If the race was a little bit more lopsided, then you know the candidate who's trailing usually does want a third party candidate in there, maybe to gang up on the candidate who's leading. But in this case, sure, Neither of them want that.
Khalid on Twitter asks, once parties get above 5% of the electorate, don't they get automatic ballot access? Aren't more choices a core American value? So there are some substantive results of third party candidates having at least modest victories in the presidential contest. Is that right, Lori?
Absolutely. And I think it may be good for the candidates that they didn't make it into the debate, but it's not good for our political discourse. I think the more views, the more people who weigh in and feel like their views are represented in the process, the better. And so it's really short-sighted to think, okay, we're just going to keep them out for as long as we can because the sentiments aren't going to go away.
And Ted Barfield on Twitter points out that Hillary Clinton's position on TPP, in fact, was highly correlated with pressure coming on her from Bernie Sanders,
who
was campaigning on a very, very anti-trade basis. So that's an example of, as you said, Lori, third-party candidates, even if they can't win, really, really altering the discourse.
Well, you know, the one thing that I think candidates realize, but they generally realize it too late, is that every election is different. Every election brings in a new slew of voters, younger voters, people that may have been sitting on the sidelines before. And you can't just go on history. You have a whole different set of people to attract that, quite frankly, weren't around when Bill was in office. They weren't anywhere near and weren't around when Barack Obama was first elected. You know, time goes on. It's just new people. And now they're all standardized.
Greg, last word on this topic goes to you.
Yeah, and this might well be the election where, exactly as Charles was saying, where the millennial voters, it might not be double digits for the third party candidates, but they show much more openness. And decades later, that will matter. You know, if a 21-year-old's first vote was for a third party candidate, they'll remember that. And they might be much more open to voting third party 10 years down the line.
You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB. The time is 3:39, and the date is September the 16th, Friday. Yay! And we're going to be right back after this break.
Time is running out for your chance to give our fall membership campaign a head start and win a St. Simon's Island getaway for two. Go to gpb.org now to do your part and enter to win this vacation for two with a three-night oceanfront stay at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. Relax on the beach, play golf, and enjoy meals in the resort's oceanfront dining room. That's gpb.org. Thank you for your support and good luck.
After two terms under the nation's first black president, we look at how President Obama's time has affected African American life.
Black America is like a caboose on a train. When the train speeds up, the caboose speeds up, but it's still the caboose.
I'm Kelly McEvers. Has the promise of hope and change come through for Black America? Later on All Things Considered.
You can hear All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock right here on GPB.
It's Political Rewind from GPB. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Bill Nygut on this Friday. We're talking about the week's news in politics, both at the national level and at the state level here in Georgia. With me is Charles Richardson. He's the opinion page editor for the Telegraph newspaper in Macon. Also with us in the GPB Macon studio is Lori Johnson, who is a political science professor at Mercer. I'm a journalism professor at Mercer. I mentioned that because we're going to be talking about higher ed for the next last 15 or so minutes of the program, and I just want to make sure that everyone knows that my cards are on the table, and we're also going to be talking about our own institution, Mercer University, Lori. So this is all by way of saying disclosure. Yes, I teach at Mercer, too. Greg Bluestein.
For how long?
We'll have about 15 more minutes, I reckon. Greg Bluestein is a political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he's up by himself in Atlanta. Macon has taken over the political discourse in Georgia on this Friday, and we're all very
and
happy about that.
And full disclosure, I went to University of Georgia. In case we need that for the upcoming discussion.
Little triangle. You got Athens on the triangle now. Okay. Exactly.
All right, one question for you, Greg. Are you a Conrad Frank?
I am.
Then you're all right with me,
He's
baby.
He's the reason I was at the Associated Press for 7 years before I moved to the AJC.
So you're all right with me, baby.
There I go.
All righty, guys. So at the start of this school year, a couple interesting things happened. The University of Chicago's Dean of Students sent out a letter to freshmen saying that his school, the University of Chicago, does not do trigger warnings or safe spaces to protect students from ideas that may be challenging or upsetting to them. More recently, this week, the faculty of the University of Chicago has come out with a letter that said, actually, we get to make that decision, not the dean of students. We decide what we do in our classes. Thank you very much. And the faculty also encouraged their students to fight for safe spaces and such. And something similar but a little bit different happened at our school, Lori, Mercer University, this year. But first, I want to talk about the University of Chicago case. And I think maybe we should just define some terms here. Lori, could you venture a definition of safe space?
Well, I think the origins of safe space come from, particularly, my understanding is from the LGBT community, mm-hmm. needing a place where it was okay to be out and not be judged and condemned for that.
Not just judged and not be beaten to death, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, I don't think people are really worried about fights breaking out in our classrooms at the university.
Right.
So safe space has morphed into something broader than that, and whether it actually is a desire of students to have that, I'm not so sure.
How would you define it now?
I mean, I do think that there is difficulty in talking about controversial topics, but part of what we have to learn to do in the classroom is model that. But there is, and empirically, I think the evidence cuts both ways, but certainly anecdotally among professors, we definitely have students who want their hands held and want to be sort of walked through everything and protected from things that are hard or uncomfortable.
Or upsetting, right. I'm going to venture a definition of trigger warning, if everybody is okay with that. So trigger warning similarly has a pretty specific origin. It came out of, if a class was going to deal with sexual assault or any related topic, that there would be a warning, just a fair warning given to the class before that was going to be discussed. And that could be anything ranging from, you know, a class discussion about sexual assault to just looking at artwork, looking at a classical piece of artwork featuring the rape of a mythological character. Those things happen. And when you consider the fact that sexual assault is incredibly pervasive on university campuses and the odds are virtually certain that every class is going to have someone who has been sexually assaulted, perhaps even quite recently, the idea was this was a particular case where we needed to give people fair warning that they, if they needed to engage in some self-care in order to make it through the rest of the class, that they could do that. Now, just like safe space, trigger warning has broadened to refer to advance warnings about all kinds of things that could potentially be upsetting to students. Charles, I want to come to you now. You're an African-American man who went to college a long, long time ago.
A long time ago. Before there were safe spaces, before there were trigger warnings.
Could you have used some of them, though?
You know, I'll be honest, I don't really believe so. But the time was very different then. I think that, and also being an African-American man that played football, people didn't just get in your face like that. And if they did, there were certain consequences that were paid.
I bet.
So, you know, you didn't have to really worry about that. I went to a school that was really about the size of Mercer, about 4,000 students. Most folk knew each other. We talked about some very, very difficult subjects. But remember, in the 70s, it was a very different conversation. Mm-hmm. It was more of a conversation about Southeast Asia and where we should be in that particular war and who was going there and who was fighting and who was demonstrating and who was doing all that. So it was more of an internal struggle, not for the hearts and minds of the college and professors, but, you know, what is our government doing about all of this? Now it's a battle of ideas that where they be gay, lesbian, straight. We had gay, lesbian, straight folk then, too. Mm-hmm. And everybody knew who they were, but we left them alone.
Right.
We protected them. But that wasn't the case in a lot of places. But we didn't have safe spaces, as it were, and we didn't have trigger warnings. We actually had some professors that actively pushed our buttons, from talking about the Black mm-hmm. Panthers at the time, you know, Angela Davis, all the stuff going on in Berkeley. But it was, again, a very different time.
Greg Bluestein, I think that you and I are both about the same age, 30-something dudes. Mm-hmm. How does all of this talk compare to your college experience?
Yeah, I'm with you. So I'm an edge millennial. I'm 34.
Is that a term?
That's a new one.
I call
edge millennials. We're edge millennials. I have an identity. Thank goodness.
I've coined it. I'm 34. I've got two kids, and I just came back from my brother's bachelor party in Roatan, Honduras, with a bunch of real millennials who were running around with GoPros on their shoulders and taking pictures of everything they did, like it was body cameras or something. I was just prefacing this with, I don't get a lot of what my generation does. I think all this plays in, the trigger warnings, the safe spaces, plays into the perception that other generations have of us as coddled, as the trophy generation, as the people that kind of needed their hands held all the time. And it does disturb me a little bit because at University of Georgia's campus, no one was giving us warnings when we were about to see something that was going to challenge us. And no one was, and professors like Conrad Fink, like you mentioned earlier, were more than eager to challenge us because they knew what was waiting for us outside.
But again, it's not just about being challenged. It can also be about being threatened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you and I, Greg, both white dudes, not particularly vulnerable demographics. And so let me just read some tweets, people tweeting us at politics, at PoliticsGPB. Twitter, trigger warnings are not censorship. They are just alerting people with trauma so that they can prepare themselves. Robbie Medwed, friend of the show, says trigger warnings don't stifle speech. They just say, I'm going to talk about this now just so that you know it's coming. And Robbie points out that Hillel on campus is an example of a safe space. The Christian Center is mm-hmm. a safe space. They're places to recharge before heading back out into a potentially more contentious and more diverse student environment. Okay, so I want to turn the page now, guys. And I should remind everybody, you're listening to Political Rewind here on GPB. I'm Adam Ragusea. With me in the studio is Lori Johnson, political science professor at Mercer University, Telegraph of Macon editorial page editor Charles Richardson, and AJC political reporter Greg Bluestein. And we're talking about safe space culture, for lack of a better slug, with the remaining 10 minutes or so that we've got here on Political Rewind. And we were just talking about how the University of Chicago, at the start of the new academic year, sent out a letter to freshmen. The dean of students, I should say, of the University of Chicago sent out a letter to freshmen saying, hey, we don't do trigger warnings or safe spaces here at the University of Chicago. Buckle up, putting aside the fact that the dean of students had absolutely no authority to say that on behalf of the entire university.
Oops.
Also struck me as a relatively unnuanced comment. Let's now and look at, I think it's safe to say, a more nuanced version of that argument. Also at the start of the school year, the president of Lori and I, our university, Bill Underwood, Mercer University President Bill Underwood, he gave an address to freshmen at convocation where he said something, I think, a little bit smarter. And I don't just say that because he's my boss. And by the way, people are going to think I'm in the tank for Bill Underwood, but that would be news to Bill Underwood, in whose side I have been a thorn and my students have been a thorn. Anyway, Underwood talked about an incident on campus that happened last year. Somebody chalked Trump 16, build the wall, on campus at Mercer. And some students came to our dean of students at Mercer and said, hey, what are you going to do about this? This is hate speech on our campus. And our dean of students said, I'm going to do absolutely nothing about it. This is protected political speech. Now, President Underwood talked about this, and he talked about his dean of students as having made the right decision in this case. But then Underwood went on, however, to say that he does not like that speech, that build the wall speech. Let's listen to what the president said.
I think Mr. Trump's immigration proposals are bad ideas. I think they would tend to alienate more than 1.6 billion Muslims around the world who are essential allies in our shared struggle against ISIS terrorists posing as Sunni ultra-fundamentalists. Moreover, I think those proposals undermine one of the most fundamental of our American values, a commitment to ensuring that people are free to practice their faith without any form of retribution by the government.
Now, some Mercer students reacted rather badly to those comments from President Underwood. They felt like he was exploiting or maybe abusing his position of authority up there and trying to foist a partisan view on that point. But the President Underwood made it clear that he was making that argument by way of illustration. He was simply saying that even though I find this political speech not only just dumb, but also threatening to my identity as a Baptist. This is something that he talked about in the speech as well. And yet he wants to tolerate it anyway. Underwood said he thinks that a university should be a marketplace of ideas. And in a free market, you let all of the ideas be expressed and you have faith that the best ones will win. Lori, is that faith justified?
I think, you know, it's a nice theory. It certainly underpins our free speech doctrine. And President Underwood is a lawyer, so he knows the First Amendment quite
sure
well.
Does.
But I think what it misses is that speech actually can be hurtful and harmful. And that doesn't mean you can't say it, but it does mean you need to pay attention to the consequences.
Right.
What I say to my students is free speech does not mean free from consequences. Mm. And so what those consequences are, what you bring up in other people, is part of your responsibility to understand.
But what are legitimate consequences for that kind of speech in a university context? So we can all imagine that chalking build the wall could be really, really alienating and almost threatening to students, to vulnerable student populations. If you're someone whose family recently immigrated, that is a direct message at you saying, we don't like that you're here. You're not welcome. And I think that maybe a lot of people would feel that is unfortunate, but then what is the university supposed to do? Is a legitimate consequence for a university administrator to step in and say, listen, we're going to treat build the wall as hate speech. If you go out and you chalk that, then there's going to be consequences for you.
No, I mean, I think, and this example is maybe an easy one because it is so quintessentially political speech, which enjoys the most protection under the First Amendment. But it should be the conversation starter, not the conversation ender. And so if that's how it makes you feel, we need to have a conversation about that. We need to have a panel about what build the wall means to people who aren't supportive of that and why. So it should enhance the conversation. And there absolutely is speech that's designed to shut down conversations. And I think that's a different category that we do have to be careful about.
The whole purpose of a university or any educational institution is to teach students how to think. And you want them to be able to think on their feet, on their own, and to be able to hear different sides of a debate and to be able to decide for themselves from being taught how to think, well, this point makes sense, this point doesn't. And you can't do that if you never get a chance to have that conversation starter. So I would agree with Lori 100%.
Adam, this same thing happened at Emory University earlier this year.
Students
walked around campus noticing Trump 2016 scrawled all over stairs, all over buildings, and immediately launched a protest against the university, calling for the students who were behind the chalkings to be reprimanded in some way. And it became an international incident. Newt Gingrich chimed in. Trump supporters said students should get thicker skin. Critics of Trump said that this was threatening and they saw sort of a racial subtext in it that was threatening to minority students and Hispanic students in particular. And it just sort of spiraled until the university president actually ended up sanctioning a sort of a mini investigation about whether or not they could even charge the student if they found him or her who chalked it and realized they couldn't. It was free speech. But until that happened, his response was he actually was filmed scrawling a chalk message of his own, which was Emory stands for free expression. So that was the answer at Emory, which was somewhat akin to the answer at Mercer.
Okay, so if we're going to go with this idea that the university is properly a marketplace of ideas, a free market, and the best ideas
will
hopefully win.
Well, it's not necessarily free.
Well, this is what I'm going to say, all right? If
Emory ain't free.
If our students – well, good point. Okay, good joke. But I mean this in a substantive way. Mm-hmm. If our – we're both professors here at
right.
Mercer Laurie. Okay, if our students were fully equipped, fully prepared to be participants in a free marketplace of ideas – they wouldn't need to be here.
Right.
Like, we're getting them trained up. So shouldn't we be regulating this marketplace a little bit in the meantime?
Well, and I think, yes, especially in the sense that not all the ideas are equally persuasive or valid. We are training them how to tell the difference between those things. So we have to talk about that. We can't treat all ideas as if they are equally persuasive or empirically correct. In part, that's how we've gotten into this political mess we're in now,
right.
Is that somehow being able to say, no, that's just wrong,
yeah.
is not okay.
And that's what I personally found so discouraging about a number of our students reacting negatively to what President Underwood said about how all the bad things he said about Trump's immigration policies directed toward Muslims, because this is objectively true what he is saying, is that this is
right.
a policy that would be blatantly unconstitutional. And that is not an observation to which there are two sides.
Well, there are not two sides, but you know, sometimes we take this fair and balanced thing a little bit too far, mm-hmm. and we forget to call out what's wrong is wrong, and this is why. Now, there are some folks that really don't care that it's wrong. But, you know, you say, hey, you got free speech. Colin Kaepernick, you don't have free speech. Or, you know, if I don't agree with you, you don't have free speech. We forget all of our early civic lessons. And then if we ever had them. You know, but I think we have free speech, but we don't have free speech to use a long-used phrase, walk into a theater and yell fire.
Sure.
You know, and I think we're teaching our students how to distinguish between someone that is just railing and someone that is actually using reasoned debate. And that takes a guide. And
it does.
And that's what you two do.
And we model it in the classroom. Yes, I will talk with students sometimes about my personal opinions, but I also think it's my responsibility to correctly characterize the opposing views too, but that doesn't mean they're all equal. And I've had actual conversations with colleagues about, is it okay to tell a student that their answer is wrong?
Right, yeah.
Yes.
I hope so.
If I don't, who will?
Yeah.
Last thought goes to you, Greg. Just 20 seconds.
Well, I was, it better be okay to tell students they're wrong, because otherwise, how would they learn? I just don't, yeah.
Conrad Fink didn't bother to tell you you were wrong, did he?
Yes, he did. Over and over and over again.
Yeah, I suppose the very exercise of going to a university is to subject yourself to someone else's authority, right?
Right.
And if
yes.
you don't want to do that, don't come.
Okay.
All righty, guys. A big thanks to The Telegraph's Charles Richardson, AJC political reporter Greg Bluestein, and Laurie Johnson, poli-sci professor at Mercer University. This has been a great conversation. Have yourself a great weekend, guys.
Be good.
You too, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
All right, remember, folks, that you can always tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We love hearing from you. Later this month, we are having yet another special edition of Political Rewind with an all-voter panel. That's you, our listeners. If you'd like to be on the show, give us a call and tell us why you think your opinion is worth hearing and why you'd be good for the show. Again, that number is 678-757-4472. Thanks for joining us for Political Rewind. Bill Nigut will be back with you next week. I'm Adam Ragusea.